I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross. It's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics. Along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel joining me over Zoom video conference. Oklahoma is looking at the lowest turnout in almost a decade for the number of candidates to file for election. By the end of last week, 285 people filed to run in races for state legislature, U.S. House, and corporation commissioner. And last-minute withdrawals earlier this week included one prominent incumbent to bow out of the race. Neva, what are your thoughts on the officials' start of the 2024 election?
Well, first of all, it's official, and I think that's the big relief for folks in the political world, those running, those supporting, those just wanting to get kind of get this 2024 cycle in full swing. So I think when you look at those numbers and the filings, like you said, Michael, I mean, I think it's actually perhaps the lowest in maybe two decades. Back in 2012, there were 275 filings, I think it was. So I think 10 more this year. Bottom line is, in election seasons like this, we saw more people, the elections being decided at 5 o'clock last Friday when the ink dried on all of those papers. And 50 of the 120, I think 127 state and House seats, they were finished for re-election because they were decided, because they were unopposed. And then you have about 35 races that are going to be settled with a June 18th primary, or potentially a handful of those may push off into an August runoff. But by and large, by the time we get to November, the drama will really be the national election, not elections taking place in Oklahoma. And I think some of that's predicated on the fact that we don't have but one statewide secondary race on the ballot this year, a corporation commission seat. We don't have the governor, lieutenant governor on down the ballot. And that does tend to kind of change the dynamic sometimes of intensity out there of people looking to run for political office. I think kind of parallel with that conversation is the fact that I think we should take note and frankly applaud the Oklahoma State Election Board and Paul Zurichs, the Election Board Secretary, and his capable staff for conducting a very smooth process where people, when they came to the Capitol for filing or in the courthouses where they filed for courthouse races, that they had a process that was seamless. They were able to get it done with no hitches or controversy, and I think folks should take note of that we have a process that works well, and that they were prepared for any contingency. And frankly, it didn't appear that they had very many hiccups, at least that were observed or talked about. So filing is come and gone. Now we will commence with the elections, which in the instance of these primaries are right around the corner.
Ryan.
Well, and Neva, you mentioned the large number of incumbents that were reelected. If you look at the Oklahoma House of Representatives that has 101 members, I think that 88 members were seeking reelection. And then, Michael, as you noted, a prominent Republican at the end of the week withdrew his candidacy. And that was Representative Kevin McDougall, who said that he's now going to focus on his business that he says is taking off right now, and he wants to really put his focus on that. And so he withdrew at the end of the week. But over half of the 87 House incumbents that were seeking re-election were elected by the fact that they had no opposition. That says a lot about who is at the Capitol and what they're doing. I think that you can look at that a couple of different ways. One, you can look at that and say, every one of those members that was reelected has a mandate now from their district to go keep doing what you're doing. But at the same time, it also means that the voters in those districts won't have any sort of voice whenever they go to the ballot box, and there won't be any sort of a competition of ideas or competition of candidates. As somebody who, whenever I ran for reelection, I always had somebody file against me. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. There is a certain amount of angst that I have towards you if you're able to get reelected without an opponent. Those folks, they get to go on vacation with their families. They get to go knock some doors for their friends that are out running for reelection. But that sort of Damocles that's hanging over you throughout the entire election cycle, if you're out there knocking doors, trying to raise money and doing everything you need to do to get reelected, that's tough. Even if you get somebody that you consider a nominal opponent, you have to take it seriously and you have to get into full gear in terms of raising money and getting out there on the doorsteps and trying to win reelection. Even you mentioned primaries. I haven't counted yet, but a great number of these races will be decided in the primaries. So we'll see. I think a lot of what the legislature will look like will be set either after June, or if we run into some runoffs into August, we'll see that. And those are going to be some big races themselves. I think on the Democratic side, we see some races that are going to be decided in the primary. One on the Senate side that I think is of particular interest is the incoming Senate President Pro Temp, Greg McCourtney, who's currently the floor leader, now has a challenge in the Republican primary. I'm assuming at this point that that person's going to try to run to the right, President Pro Temp-elect McCourtney, and we'll see a lot of the same charges that were brought against him during that Pro Temp race, but in a more local context in a state Senate race. I think that if Senator McCourtney stays true to who he is and his record in the Senate, he should be able to win that race. But whenever you're talking about a primary, they can be very unpredictable because you have turnout issues, low turnout potentially. Like you said, Neva, there's not a big national campaign. In June, we're not going to have some big draw to the polls. So what turnout looks like there could decide a lot of what these primaries ultimately shake out or how they shake out.
That's right, because even these congressional primaries in the state will not be viewed as very competitive, obviously. And I think the other point about just that the 35 primaries, as you say, Ryan, I mean, when those are decided in June or finally in August, it leaves very few races, I mean, from the legislative standpoint, that will still be in play in November. Many of those, while there will be competition, when you look at the makeup of the district, I mean, you have heavily favored Republican districts that obviously that is going to bode well for the Republican nominee. There are districts like the one you described that has been a Democrat seat and will be heavily favored by the Democrat, just given the composition of the district. But the fact that you went when you mentioned that Representative McDougall withdrew after he had filed last week, it was interesting because the person who was in the race with him, the Republican, was someone, by his own admission, someone that was a friend he went to church with, a longtime associate. So that looked like a switcheroo of, Representative McDougall in, but then withdrawing, and someone that he obviously knows and appears to be very comfortable with, his likely successor, even though I think there's a Democrat in that race for November. And then you had on Tuesday of this week, the final or the last day of withdrawing, you had Senator Kidd, Chris Kidd from Waurika, who also withdrew with no real explanation. And that leaves a primary with, I think, two or three candidates in that race that will decide who their next senator will be. So there's always a little bit of intrigue, a little bit of drama, but the takeaway from this election season is that we had the House leadership, the top four folks, term limited, Charles McCall, John Eccles, Terry O'Donnell, and Mark McBride. And on the Senate side, you had five that were term limited, including Pro Tem Greg Treat, Rob Standridge, Nathan Dom, and then the Democrat leader Kay Floyd and Kevin Matthews. So there'll be a lot of institutional knowledge walking away after this session, and it'll be interesting to see how the new players mix with new leadership as we move forward.
A task force created by Governor Stitt wants lawmakers to eliminate the cap on individual donors can give to state politician campaigns. Currently, a candidate can receive just shy of $10,000 from an individual. Ryan, what do you think about the recommendations from Stitt and his task force on campaign finance and election threats?
Well, I think we can see where this task force came from. It was, I think it's a direct result of Governor Stitt having faced re-election, where his general election opponent, Joy Hofmeister, raised a considerable amount of money in her own right into her campaign. And Governor Stitt raised a considerable amount of money in his own right to his campaign. But then you had a lot of outside moneyed interest that spent record amounts of campaign expenditures in the state of Oklahoma. And a lot of that favored his opponent, then Superintendent Joy Hofmeister. So it's not a surprise that you see the governor come forward with a task force that targets these dark money groups and tries to find some sort of equilibrium between the individual campaigns and these dark money operations. But at the same time, I think that we need to point out that the composition of this task force is hardly a team of rivals that we might have seen from somebody like Abraham Lincoln. You know, President Lincoln was famous for bringing in disparate voices and putting them all in a room and saying, I want to hear all of these different perspectives. I want to talk about all of these different possibilities. Really, what you saw of these members on this task force was a cognitive feedback loop. Mm-hmm. I think almost everyone in this task force that's appointed there is someone who shares a similar philosophy with one another and with the governor. And we probably didn't see a lot of robust conversation about alternatives to the recommendations that ultimately came out in this. I think it's interesting to think about what it would be like to put to eliminate the caps on individuals. You know, presumably you would still have disclosure requirements there, and maybe we could see where more of this money is coming from. But at the same time, I don't know that that's the only solution that we're faced with, and that we have on the table. Another solution would be to impose greater disclosure requirements on dark money groups themselves, and that was part of what this task force did. But I would suggest that the task force go even further and that we have an opportunity to know more about who's behind these dark money groups. The Supreme Court and Citizens United and in subsequent cases has said that the First Amendment prohibits limitations on these groups and their ability to weigh in on these elections as long as they're not coordinating with campaigns. Mm. But they did not say, the Supreme Court did not say that states can't put greater disclosure requirements on those groups themselves. So I think that that's an opportunity for the state to move forward. And another thing that this task force threw out there was proposing a ban on open primaries or proposing a ban on ranked choice voting. And there really wasn't a discussion of what either of those two things might do to curtail some of the issues that we just talked about in our previous segment, which is that an overwhelming majority of the state legislature right now is going to be either elected without opposition or they're going to be selected in primary and runoffs. And the general election races that I think that we all used to think of as, you know, this November is when we decide who is going to represent us. Really, at this point, it's June and August is when we decide who's going to represent us, because even once we get to November, we don't really have competitive, or have very few, at least, competitive general elections out there. So that wasn't really on the table for discussion in terms of what this task force was looking at. They just said, we've got to ban ranked choice voting. We've got to not do these open primaries because they're inefficient. And they pointed to a couple of examples, but they really didn't have a robust discussion, which, again, not surprising given the composition of the task force.
Neva.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the task force, their recommendations will go to the legislature, the election board, and the ethics commission, because it will be these respective bodies that would have to specifically address and take actions like they outline in this report. And I think, as you said, Ryan, I mean, the discussion about increasing giving amounts for donors has always been a discussion, and incrementally it's gone up over the last decade, a few hundred dollars each time. I mean, there haven't been these big leaps in terms of the number the cap on what the giving amount is. Right now, the maximum any Oklahoman, any individual giving to an Oklahoma campaign is $3,300 per individual per election. So if you have a primary runoff in general, obviously that number can go up. But when you look at that number, approximately, if they were a donor were to weigh in with a candidate they really liked in three elections, you still would be talking a little under $10,000 as a donation. You work that against what you talk about with these IEs, unlimited dollars coming out for or against candidates or issues with very little scrutiny. I mean, that is the operating factor that really makes it an unlevel playing field when you have these groups coming out, particularly with candidates where they're coming out heavily against them in a campaign. So I think this is a discussion point that there's a lot of interest in talking about it, whether or not they actually move to unlimited donations or something much, much higher, I think remains to be seen. Very few states, frankly, have gone down that road. I think Texas and Oregon are probably the two most talked about states where they actually have unlimited donations. But that is coupled with the fact that you still have a lot of accountability because you have you do have the reporting factor. And I think that's what individuals want to see in place. You can go online and find out every donation and every expenditure that these candidates are making in their campaigns. You can't do that with the IEs or these independent expenditures. So I think that's a discussion point. I thought the other takeaway from their report was the fact that they talked about election security and made the point that Oklahoma continues to lead the nation in election integrity, and talked about the fact that we have a system that has been proven to be excellent over and over. Talked about the fact that the accuracy of the Oklahoma election results have been confirmed time and time again, not only through manual audits, post-election audits, but also when there have been candidate-requested recounts. So I think that is something the public hopefully recognizes and continues to pay attention to, because with all of the backdrop nationally of so much conversation about election security, to know that we continue to be a leader across the nation in terms of how we conduct our elections. And I think this group, this task force, further validated that by making those statements in their final report.
Oklahoma Congressman Tom Cole is taking the gavel as chairman of the powerful U.S. House Appropriations Committee. Cole was the only person to throw his hat in the ring to replace Texas Republican Kay Granger. Neva, what does this mean for Oklahoma?
Well, I think it means, like we talked about last week, it means something big. I mean, this is something that should be noted. Tom Cole is the first Oklahoman to ever serve in this post in history. And this is one of, if not the second most high-profile position in the United States Congress behind Speaker of the House. I mean, this is an opportunity for Congressman Cole to really show what more than two decades of service on the Appropriations and Budget Committee and all of the work that he has done, the rapport he has built, the respect that he has earned from his colleagues, and the fact that when it got down to it, he was unopposed. I mean, it's a closed room effort that takes place, a vote among colleagues. But out of that, what we saw was a consensus behind Tom Cole to be the person to be the chairman of the AMB. And he says he's hitting the ground running. That there's much work to be done. We're talking about a $1.7, I think, trillion budget. I mean, talking about the fact that they have to continue to build consensus and work not only looking toward the next fiscal year, but finishing up what's in front of them right now, and the fact that there is they've still got to work toward keeping the country running through these measures that they have to do given the fact that there is a very strained Congress and a lot of opposing viewpoints on what to do when you start talking about how to spend the money, where it goes, and the fights that continue to ensue in that front. So Congratulations to Congressman Cole. I mean, he has certainly earned this position. I think he is certainly someone that, without really any dispute, is highly qualified, if not the most qualified member of Congress to serve. And I think going forward, we will see a lot of his fingerprints on what takes place in terms of the negotiating and the give and take. And as he said, I mean, there is compromise in this process, because if you don't, you don't get anything done. So he's someone to be congratulated. And as I say, I think Oklahomans by and large may pay much more attention to some of what goes on now in Congress, because they'll be seeing someone they recognize making statements and out front leading with respect to appropriations and the budget.
Ryan.
Well, my congratulations to Chairman Cole. This is, as Neva said, well-deserved. He's earned this position with his strength and command of budgetary issues at the Capitol. He's well-respected among his colleagues. This is evident that he didn't have any opposition for one of the most powerful positions in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he is the first Oklahoman to hold this position, when you think about Oklahomans that have held high-ranking positions at Congress in general, I mean, we think of the likes of Senator Kerr. We think of the likes of Speaker Carl Albert, the only Oklahoman to hold the top position in the United States House of Representatives. And now we have Appropriations Chairman Tom Cole. That is rarefied air to be breathing. And Chairman Cole even relayed to a reporter that one of the first calls he got after securing the position was someone telling him that, you know, that Carl Albert may have been Speaker, but being Chairman of Appropriations is even better than being Speaker. So I think that Chairman Cole will handle this job as well as anyone can handle it. The question is whether anyone can manage what is happening within Congress right now. You have a Speaker of the House, the second in a row, that is on very tenuous footing within their own caucus. There are big issues like continuing spending resolutions that are in front of Congress that need to happen. You've got budget fights within the Republican caucus itself in Congress that may present some very difficult positions for not just Chairman Cole, but for the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. There's questions as to whether or not the current Speaker of the House is going to have to rely on Democratic votes in the event that there's a call for a new Speaker's election. That could put things like funding for Ukraine on the congressional table. That could put things like funding for humanitarian support in Gaza, or do we provide increased aid to Israel? There are a lot of really thorny questions that have political landmines all in front of Chairman Cole. Now, if anyone can navigate that, I believe that he's the one that can navigate that. And then at the end of the rainbow, you have elections coming up in November, where there's a chance that Democrats could wrest control from the Republicans and they could come into the majority. And then we would see, you know, the minority leader on the Appropriations Committee would most likely continue to be, you know, the current chairman, Cole. But there's so many variables out there. But if there's anyone out there that is ready to handle this, I truly believe that it's Congressman Cole. And Oklahomans should celebrate the fact that one of our own has assumed this enormous leadership position in Washington.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, and noteworthy that Congressman Cole's fourth congressional district that he represents is also a district that is viewed as very, very, very federally heavy as a district. And what I mean by that is he has almost 25,000 federal employees in his congressional district, one of the largest in the country. And the reason is he's got five military installations in the district, as well as a number of other entities that are have federal employees contracted there. So he understands that dynamic. He understands Native American interests. One of the things he talked about was that that had been an issue, not really always front and center, but certainly will be a focus of his, as well as many other things that he brings to the table with his background on AMB and the work he's done in transportation, HHS, a lot of these areas where he has hands-on working knowledge that will bode well for not only those subcommittee chairs in some positions he's already held, but the fact that he has been a negotiator in the budget process for a number of years in his role on that AMB committee.
The leader of the state Senate is throwing down the gauntlet over the budget process at the state Capitol. President Pro Tem Greg Tree says his chamber will not hear any House appropriations bills until the speaker releases a budget plan, just as the Senate did last month. And to prove its point, the Senate Appropriations Committee has canceled its past two meetings. Ryan, what's the feeling at the state Capitol?
Well, and we're taping on Thursday morning, so what we might learn later today after this goes to the podcast, which if you're not listening to the podcast, folks, you can go anywhere you download podcasts and listen to the entire conversation. But we may know even before then whether or not the Senate will extend that deadline into next week. The House has already extended their deadline for Senate bills that require appropriations into next week. That seemed that was a part of a conversation that Senate Republicans were having earlier this week. But as of this taping, I'm not aware that they've extended the deadline. So the one thing that both chambers do have in common here is that they have a common enemy in time. Whether they're extending deadlines or not, we have signing die that's required by the end of the last Friday in May, which means they've got to adjourn or they've got to go into a special session to continue a budget. Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat said that he would be open to that. And he said we could even go past May if we needed to, which, you know, for a guy that doesn't have to run for re-election because he's term limited out, is a lot easier for him to say that than it is for members that need to get out in their districts and start trying to win these primaries and position themselves to return to the Capitol as incumbents. This really comes down to that process that we've talked a lot about earlier on earlier programs, where the Senate has put out rules to try to have a more transparent budget process. Now, the way that, you know, each chamber can set their own rules, the House has said, well, the Senate can do what they want, but they can't impose that upon us. But one of the ways that it has imposed itself upon the House is that once the House gives the Senate their budget numbers, the Senate has said, as part of their new commitment to transparency, that those budget numbers that are shared kind of in an Excel spreadsheet form, once they get shared over to the Senate, they're going to be made public. And so the question for the House is, how soon are they ready to turn those over to the Senate? Because they know as soon as that happens, those numbers are going to be public very soon thereafter. And that's a big question. We also have some looming issues around supplemental appropriations for the current fiscal year with regard to some of the school funding issues from last session. This is the time of the session when we do begin to see the budget tensions and, you know, might call them fights between the two chambers. I don't think that we're at a point yet, though, where we can say that we've reached some sort of intractable position where there's not an immediate solution or resolution on the horizon. I think both chambers right now seem to be working towards a resolution.
Neva?
Well, and I think it's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, obviously, the Senate coming in appropriations and budget basically for 10 minutes and saying then they weren't going to do the 42 House bills on their docket. You had that versus in the House where they had about 50 bills, I believe, on Wednesday, same day, and they started moving through those bills. So the process seems to be kind of moving and grinding along on the House side, seems to be stopped on the Senate side. The rhetoric back and forth really is, at this point, it's not about being a budget fight. It's about whether it's a personality, a leadership, or just an intractable lack of leadership on both sides to kind of forge a consensus and move forward. It really depends on, I guess, where you are in the mix on this. But I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, the pro tem throwing down the gauntlet a little bit about will state will sign he die end of May or after, meaning special session, and that's now the word that you hear, the words being bandied about in the in the hallways around the Capitol this week is, are we really looking at a special session? That's the drama we hear every April moving into May as the budget negotiations really ramp up. It appears that the House, some of their negotiators may be, you know, having conversations with the governor's negotiators. It doesn't seem, at least from what is being said in the hallways again, that the Senate is kind of in that mix. But the bottom line is, you're right, it's an election season. A lot of these folks have to leave after they finish work on Thursday, get back in their districts, campaign all weekend long, come back. How long they can stretch that and get into May when the hours get longer and they even pick up oftentimes a Friday session. That's always the angst of this process. But bottom line, they've got to get the budget done. They always get the budget done. It just seems that there's always this kind of consternation back and forth with everyone trying to argue who's more transparent, who's doing it more out front for the public to pay attention to. And the reality is the public doesn't pay attention to any of this. I mean, we can say they have the opportunity and that it's much easier now through online streaming and the level of reporting that goes on to be able to keep up with the things that are of interest to them. But this is the work of the legislature and all of the entities and the agencies and everyone that are concerned. If they've got a flat budget, is there an opportunity to get a supplemental? Can they go back and clean up some of the issues that are being talked about that always are there, that they have to have clean up on the current fiscal budget ending where they have had issues come up and they need supplementals? All of that is negotiated back and forth, and we'll just have to see if there's some new wild card in this mix, or it's just more the give and take and sparring between the House and the Senate as they move through the budgetary process.
After less than 6 months on the job, the executive director of the Oklahoma Department of Veterans Affairs is announcing his retirement. Greg Slavonic was named director in August of last year to replace Joel Kinsel, who was fired in a controversial move by the Stitt-appointed Veterans Commission. Neva, what is going on here?
Well, I think when Greg Slavonic took the position as the interim director, he made it pretty clear he wasn't looking to be the permanent director. He came in to fill that gap, to begin to identify and address many of the problems that had been laid out there, and try to kind of regroup and put it on a solid footing in terms of the agency. By all accounts, that has been done. In fact, he moved from being the interim director to the director a few months ago, and I think there was probably some hope and expectation that he might stay longer. But now he has, in fact, submitted his plans to resign and move on. And I think now that it is incumbent upon the commission to move quickly to look for a new director, and if they have one in the offing, someone that's already being talked about, or whether this is going to be a full search and process that will obviously take much longer. This comes at a time when, again, budgets are on the table, discussions are taking place, and the continuity for this particular agency, the Department of Veterans Affairs, is that he will be in the mix right now to at least bridge the gap through this session and be able to hopefully have a seamless handoff with the next director when chosen.
Ryan.
Yeah, and I think that's right. Is the biggest issue here is continuity for an incredibly important agency that provides a range of services for the men and women that have served our country and that are in Oklahoma. It is unfortunate that we have seen a lack of stability for since Joel Kinsel stepped down or was pushed out, or however you want to talk about that. The last long serving director of the department. So I agree with Neva. The admiral had said whenever he came into this position that it was 6 months and then he was going to step down. Well, he appears to be a man of his word, and he's leaving whenever about the time that he said he is going to leave. I do think it's important to get somebody placed in that position as soon as possible, so that even if they are not on the ground by the end of this legislative session, that they're in a position where they can begin to prepare themselves, their agency, for the next legislative session that will kick off in 2025.
Orion and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. Programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny May Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.
Step into the world of limitless imagination with Beyond the Art podcast, where Indigenous creativity knows no bounds. Join me, Corey Beaumont Flynn, host of Beyond the Art, on a captivating journey through art and innovation, where we delve into the depths of imagination, daring to push the boundaries of what's possible. Our guests, hailing from the Native American art world, represent diverse artistic sectors, from musicians to photographers, beadwork artists to filmmakers, each sharing their unique creative vision and inspiring journeys. Search for Beyond the Art and start listening today.